Well, hey guys, I know I'm a minute or so early, but I wanted to come on as early as possible and address any questions you have. Thank you so much for sending the questions. So many of you have addressed those two questions in very meaningful and important ways, and I promise I will work in a response to each of the questions and the goals that you have. Today we're going to talk about the aspects of how to change mind, brain, and behavior. So we're going to address some of the aspects of, from a coaching perspective, how do we address change with clients. We did an overview last time, and that was sort of more theoretical about looking at change and transition stages and phases. We're going to be applying that and look at some how-to this time in terms of addressing change that will facilitate work with clients. Next time, we're going to look at a macro system of how to really deconstruct a story, to look at the algorithms of mind and brain, mostly brain in this instance, about how to understand a story and revise the storylines for our clients in specific ways. So there's a system to do. Remember I mentioned in the at the beginning of the beginning, if you want to change something, change a habit, create a new habit, change a behavior, look at the system, not just the goal. So we're going to be doing that. We looked at a larger perspective last time. We're going to look at some aspects of how to do that this time, and then a different kind of way of addressing a client story next time. So thank you for all of your questions and thoughts. The one question that I wanted to specifically answer, because it's not something I'm wrapping into the discussion today, is how do you keep a client from going back to the source of the pain to recreate the problem and look at it? If I could get each of you to manage the background noise, especially if you're on a cell phone or a computer phone, the technology for the teleconference lines has not caught up for some reason, but regardless, mute if you would, star six, and then be sure and unmute when you're ready to come back and ask a question or comment. I'll put us on lecture mode when I get to the presentation part, so you don't have to worry about it. But the question about how you keep a client from going back to the source of the pain, even after setting new goals and making progress, it's a great question, because this is a distinction of coaching from all other professions. Every other profession, if you think about it, doc, dentist, attorney, CPA, financial professional, psychiatrist, psychologist, therapist, counselor, looks at a problem, and at least in the first group, they'll tell you the answers or tell you what to do in a consultancy model, or look back, if in counseling or therapy, to re-enter the old story, write a better ending, resolve, understand, look at the dynamics. We do something different in coaching. Two things. We engage in a collaborative framework, meaning that we and the client together engage in looking at and exploring possibilities instead of problems, and to co-create ways to move ahead in doing that. We are specialists at change and experts at choice architecture, as I mentioned last time. So that looks at now and next. So if someone goes back into a problem, then we will redirect them to look at it now. Now, the first thing, and we'll talk more about this, when someone has an emotional component that's in the foreground, they're upset, they're preoccupied, they're worried, they're anxious, the first step is always state before strategy and story, meaning that just an empathic resonance with the client's experience can help the client know that we understand, so that we can go someplace new with the client. We touched on this a bit last time, and this is especially important in working with clients. So we're going to talk today more about the actual work with clients and how to proceed with beginning with why we resist change and move from there. So any other comments or questions at this point from any of you? Remember to unmute star 6 to comment. If not, I will reserve some time for us at the end, so jot down any questions or comments that you have, and we'll have some time to discuss that, and I'll move into election mode. So why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why do they repeat behavior that doesn't work, maybe even do it harder, and expect a different result, even if it leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's the default mode. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, to the old story. People fail to change because they just don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that is synonymous with their identity. And this is important, and we'll come back to that, because for someone to change permanently, it has to evolve and transform how and who they see themselves, not just their behavior. So, we return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. If you can tuck your phone, if you don't have a headset, put your palms together in front of your face and interlock your fingers firmly. Notice, with your hand still firmly clasped, which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, firmly clasped, but change so that the other thumb is on top. How does that feel? Kind of awkward, a little bit goofy. Now, put your thumbs back in their original place. Ah, that's why people don't change. Or succeed remarkably, or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Every client, every step ahead, for each of you, us. And the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told of a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he would create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its really circuitous route. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. And he continued to do this no matter how many turns and twists. Each person followed the path of least resistance. Not one created a new, more direct path. That's how neural pathways are laid down in the brain. By early experiences, later experiences that are recreated, until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. Now, to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of that usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, or new context. That's exactly what we do as coaches. We look at possibilities, not at problems. At what a next step is, not understanding the problem or asking why questions. We're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both resist moving ahead and react to the familiar, but yet engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed or intuition of a wrong choice. In other words, whenever someone takes a step ahead and is uncertain or anxious or has trepidation, it may be interpreted as, well, this is my gut telling me it's the wrong way to go, or my intuition says it's the wrong choice, or as a signpost of change and progress. So we help a client reframe an experience of discomfort with a step ahead as validation of moving ahead, a signpost of evidence that they're in new territory and it's to be expected, so that they can self-reflect and validate that they're moving ahead and tell the difference when it's not their intuition that they're doing the wrong thing or evidence of a wrong choice. So discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism that's located very close to the emotional center in the brain. And the emotional center, through the error detection mechanism, says this isn't normal. So there's discomfort whenever we try something new. Same for change, same for transitions. It's read as something other than what the brain expects. We're going to return to that. And we'll talk later about also how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. We struggle to embrace change. I mentioned in the beginning that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to say about change and resistance to change. And I want to discuss in this session what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients, regulating states of mind. Never more important than at time of change and transition. So let's talk about understanding a state of mind. A state of mind is really a mind-body state. It's a psychophysiological state. But it's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. So each state of mind is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavioral patterns, and we each have many different states of mind. And how we respond in a state is going to be specific and consistent within that state. So here's an illustration of how states of mind are like a different software package. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the goal, and it can go again and again. Now, if you take another rat, and before you teach it to reach the goal, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine. You create or simulate a state of mild anxiety. Now, you teach the rat to get to the goal, to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, for that rat, you take away the amphetamine. The rat can't get to the cheese. The rat has in its brain an awareness, a knowledge, a map of how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it in a different state. So the rat literally in that maze could die of starvation. Now, you re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-specific memory. This is an example of two distinct states of mind without any overlap. It's really more of an extreme, kind of like in, for us it would be more like post-traumatic stress disorder, where an entire event may not be remembered in the usual way, or multiple personality disorder, where distinct states can exist side by side without the seamless blending of moving from one state to another that most of us usually experience in our lives. A more common example is when we try to think of somebody's name and can't, know it's on the tip of our tongue, but just can't recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state of mind, boom, the name comes instantly. So a state of mind is like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. Each of us has a range of states, and ideally some awareness of what state works best for which endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states, because it's important to know, become cognizant of what state to enter, for example, for a creative endeavor, or what state to use for planning. Everything from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep, all of this is about regulating states of mind. There's an additional resource for this that I'll refer you to. It's about a 30-minute free webinar on the homepage of my website, Mentor Path, that is just called Master States of Mind, and it goes into a little bit more detail of what I'm just introducing here, and it might be, there may be a little bit of redundancy, but it would be a good companion piece if you have a chance to look at this. So here's a mentor coaching application. It's important for us to be aware of and hold the mind-body state of a client to understand the subjective experience of the client as well as the story that's communicated by the client. So once we're tuned into the client and resonate with the client's experience, we are together exploring that meaning, that experience with the client. And this can be a collaborative framework of looking at and developing a new story together. First, we have to resonate with the client's experience. We have to get inside that circle with the stick figure inside the circle. That's your client. You have to get inside the circle before the client will listen to you. Outside, they probably won't listen. The empathic resonance is a way to get inside that circle to go someplace new together. So let's look at how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success is to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. A couple of recent studies in Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind that studied a broad range of executives to find that the most important success factor was self-awareness and regulating states of mind. Now, that was only because they studied executives. I would substitute every human being. It's important to do that. So this will be a very useful part of a repertoire of understanding for each of you as mentor coaches. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the crucial success strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to any stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. So, again, the state of mind determines the meaning we attach, and the meaning determines the behavior. So, by changing a state of mind, we change the behavior. Think about, for example, you're at home and you're out on the patio or inside in the living room. You're having a glass of wine after dinner with your partner. You hear something in the backyard, or you hear something outside, and you probably don't even notice it. If you do, you don't pay much attention to it. Now, the next night, Wednesday night, you're home. You've just seen the latest episode of Criminal Minds. You hear the same noise, and you're instantly on alert and have to check it out. Same stimulus, but the meaning is determined by the different states of mind. So that's what I mean by state of mind determines the meaning, and the meaning determines the behavior. So there are two basic ways we have as humans to regulate our states of mind, focus and physiology. Physiology is how we use our bodies to change our biochemistry and state of mind. A simple example is relaxation or deep breathing or meditation. And a focus is what and how you focus. We know from both neuroscience and quantum physics, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain. So what we pay attention to can determine our state of mind. And that determines meaning and then behavior. So your power is what you focus on. Now, let's look at that just a little bit more. Two questions we usually ask to determine what we focus on. What does this mean, and what should I do? If you have an habitual feeling you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and questions. Why does this always happen to me? Why can't I lose weight? So what you may want to do is ask a better question. Let me give you an example. I presented to a group of executives invited by their facilitator because there had been some stress with a couple of the executives, one a business owner, one a CEO. There had been some real traumas happen at each of their businesses. And after a few months, they were both still having stress. They were both still having compromises because of this. So in the group, as we developed this, I asked them to write down three questions sometime during the day that put them in a positive, empowered state of mind. Now, this was after asking them, and they talked to the group as they had talked before I got there. What was the first thing they said to them? So what was the first question they asked in the morning before they ever got out of bed? And it was usually something like, oh, what bad can happen today? Or, man, how can I cover this? How can I make up for this? How can I protect my people? So I asked them to write down three questions that would put them in an empowered, positive state of mind. And immediately in the morning, before they ever got out of bed, as soon as they turn on their bedside lamp, to take those three questions and answer them. And what we know is the first thoughts of the day, we're always asking ourselves questions, and usually that will determine a state of mind to engage the day. Think about how if you get up and stub your toe, you've got a lousy few hours ahead because you're in a negative state of mind. What these individuals did is to get back with me in less than a week, each of them, to say that it had made a powerful, positive difference for them and for their organizations, because we know that the most contagious experience is our state of mind, faster than any known virus. So that state of mind that they had of coming in and confidently and coherently addressing the things that needed to be addressed, the state of mind was contagious, and they saw it in themselves, and they saw it in their organizations. So think about that, because your brain follows your focus, whether it's positive or negative. So ask questions that empower you, that put you in a positive, engaged state of mind. And think about it in this way, too. Some of the best mentors, leaders, teachers are ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. people thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask people if they want to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And listen to how Steve Jobs convinced the former, at the time, Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO of Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or you want to change the world? So do this exercise. Try this out. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state sometime during the day. Each morning, answer these three questions and feel the answer before you ever get up. Remember, you're already asking questions anyhow. You might as well just orchestrate them. This just changes the focus to consciously engineer the questions that will empower you. So, how do you regulate states of mind more specifically? Is there a system to do this? Well, listen to this story. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach Robert Reed arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage in their division nationwide of 217 teams. So, during practice, he had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. A mantra is simply a cue, a focus, and a physiology. He suggested that the cue be two dribbles while they were saying a positive focus phrase to themselves, such as relaxed and smooth, where the words would both focus their brains and align with the action that they were taking, and to take a deep breath, focus and physiology, to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. Also, during practice, he would suddenly blow the whistle, ask them to go to the free shot line, take two free shots. If they made them both, they got to take a breather. If not, they did four laps. So this simulated game condition. So you want to practice and get things in an output channel like during a game. So after 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. So let's look at neural conditioning. What we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. To change your behavior, change your association. Thinking positively is not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to whatever has already been established in your brain in the neural networks and connections. Remember, anything that we believe, any facts that we have, any behavior that we engage in a repeated way, beliefs, behaviors, facts, these are all anatomical realities in your brain. You don't just suddenly have a new belief by finding something that sounds good and have it overwrite what you already believe. But this is where we earn our money. This is how we help people change and transform in their brains and in their minds, their hardware and their software, to create, to tolerate the story busting of moving ahead in a different way that's experienced in the first step in a new way, and to ultimately revise their storylines. So what you link inside your head, the meaning that you give, determines your behavior. You can change your behavior by changing the meaning. So here's another way to think about it. There are two forces inside all of us behind all behavior: avoiding pain and gaining pleasure. These are biological. Avoiding pain has helped us survive. Gaining pleasure helps keep us motivated because the anticipation of doing something pleasurable, of a reward, boosts up dopamine, the pleasure chemical. So to understand these two forces, the need to avoid pain being biological, so the brain fights against change to avoid pain. So trying to create success by creating more pain usually doesn't work. For any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight, because overweight's a future event. It's abstract. And that cheesecake with the strawberry topping is right there. It's about a second and a half, if you're slow, away. Overweight's an abstract idea. Being in shape is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as immediate pleasure. So, instead of the strawberry cheesecake or an abstract goal, you need a system. And that's what we're talking about. Spending money in the moment seems like a greater pleasure than the later gain of retirement funding or a savings account or avoiding debt financially and emotionally. So to change your behavior and develop a different system, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. So to find out or influence someone, discover what they are already influenced by, what they link pleasure and pain to. If you're not doing something that you need to do or want to do, you probably link more pain with doing it than not doing it. And think about this in terms of the surface and the shadow story. If the surface story, which remember is only about 5% or 10% of our operating system, is I want to make more money and generate wealth. If the shadow story goes in the opposite direction, whether it's conscious or not, and says something like, well, I'm afraid of really putting myself out there and embarrassing myself if I fail, or spiritual people don't really, you know, have a lot of money, or I don't think I'd really know what to do if I really started, or whatever other rationalization occurs that justifies stopping yourself. Stopping yourself is always the first step. Then, in the space that follows, since nature abhors a vacuum, there's a reason that makes it make sense, so that creates closure. So, if you're sabotaging success in any of your life, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and the avoidance, having fear. So here are two coaching questions for this juncture. What's the greater pain if I don't proceed? And what's the greater pleasure if I do? Now, that assumes that you have a plan and that you stop yourself. If you don't have a plan, that's the first step, is to create a plan. But if you have a plan and know what the next step is, because sometimes people don't know what the next step is and they stop themselves and it looks like resisting their goals or sabotaging their goals rather than simply avoiding pain or just not knowing exactly what the next step is. And the next step is the system that we're talking about. That's the initial part of the system. So most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago or the one they want to believe or the one that justifies stopping themselves. So for any situation, there are three components. These are all internal: state, story, and strategy. State management is the most important aspect. To choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome, state always comes first. Then, strategy is to move beliefs to behavior for successful performance. And story is the overarching organizer of what we do. It can house things like the themes and storylines or the purpose of what we do. So, in neural conditioning, and I'm gonna send you guys, I didn't want you to be distracted by it, but I'm going to send you a single-page neural conditioning chart as you think about and reflect on this session, and it'll make more sense as we get toward the end of it, about how to identify emotional triggers and how then to create a system to get grounded and centered. Always the first step, state comes first, to then have an ideal response by having already a plan for that ideal response for each emotional trigger. So how do you condition yourself? And this is a kind of an overview. How do you condition yourself to make changes that last? Well, there are three basic principles to neuroconditioning. In other words, rewiring our brain. One, identify what to change. You have to get to the point where you feel you must change something, that you need to change it now, that you can change it. And to feel that not changing would be ultimately more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. So believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. So here's some questions to ask for this step. If you don't change your pattern or your behavior, what will be the consequences? What's the specific pain associated to a current choice that you're now making? What will be the pleasure with changing? This is to deconstruct the next step. Second step, interrupt the existing pattern. Often there's the mistake, I believe, of adding a new pattern to the ones already existing. And that usually doesn't work because there's no room. That you have to unlearn something that's part and parcel of learning. It's like, you know, adding a new gym membership on top of all the other things you do. It usually doesn't have that kind of impact unless you really change the system and create a structured time each day that you go to the gym. So recognize the cues for the behavior so you can immediately interrupt it. A pattern has to be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. Because any behavior is like going down the superhighway of the familiar in your brain. You keep going and it's comfortable, it looks like progress, you don't get to where you want to be, but it's easy traveling. To change that would be to disrupt that pattern, and suddenly it's like, feels like sometimes, taking a machete in the overgrown brush by the side of that superhighway and creating a new path to where you really want to be. So you have to tolerate discomfort. Remember, comfortable is not a place you began. So, questions for step two. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern? Then, think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. And third, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, you're phobic about something. You're avoiding something. Link a strong and powerful idea or experience with the previous phobic stimulus. When you behave and feel differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. So here's some questions to ask for this step. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger, especially the emotional trigger? What is the change you want to bring about? Think of the things you gain and the pleasure you will have with that change. So, Viktor Frankl wrote a book, and I'm sure you've heard of it, Man's Search for Meaning, about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. He found that one of 25 of his fellow prisoners managed somehow to survive. So he set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. What he found was that the survivors associated something positive to their experience. 24 out of 25 focused on the instant death that was inevitable. The people that survived developed a reason to survive, to create a meaning for their suffering rather than accepting their fate and wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so they could tell their story to their children to make certain this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of their suffering. They were able to make it and had a will to live that helped them through the toughest of times. So, another way to think about it is to mindset map for growth. Our minds our brains actually work like a Google map. There's some recent evidence that shows this very vividly. Whenever we have a new situation, it's like booting up a new Google map. What we have to do is to be aware of this process to make sure those maps have a cohesive and a coherent story, so we will know how to proceed, how to make it make sense. And remember, the mindset comes first, and then the state of mind determines the meaning you attach to any cue or stimulus. To change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. So here's an application of this for coaching practice. To look at fixed and growth mindsets, a simple example of two different mindsets. A growth mindset is based on a belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You become open to accurate information about talents and abilities. You use it to adjust and to grow. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, found that people with growth mindsets have a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. And we know now that talent is developed through deliberate practice, not something you're just born with. The growth mindset is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolve throughout life. The fundamental assumption is everyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. Now, this is what we coach toward. What we address, let's listen to the fixed mindset. With a fixed mindset, people try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal is to prove oneself in the classroom, in a career, in a relationship. And a fixed mindset requires proving yourself again and again because nothing ever is quite enough. Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I succeed or fail? No amount of confirmation can dislodge this hypothesis. So a fixed mindset makes someone preoccupied with how they look. A fixed mindset shares some of these characteristics, and each of these, I would say, are coaching moments. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem may include assigning blame or making excuses. And you can't learn from mistakes as long as you deny them or externalize them. So, the question is again, what can you learn from this and how can you improve? These are things that we want to think about as mentor coaches. Here's an illustration of the impact, and I'll move to growth mindsets because that's what we're coaching toward in just a moment. But I want to illustrate this, the impact of belief and mindset. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over the three-year period of study. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test scores in these 3 years, equivalent to 8 years of normal aging. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, and even cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. They lived into their beliefs or died into it. So to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior, here are some steps. Begin where the client is. That means in that circle with the stick figure, you have to enter the circle. You do that by resonating empathically with an experience. State comes before strategy and story, and understanding their primary challenge. Help them learn more about what they already know. We look at what works. highlight positive attributes, in other words, existing neuronal networks, behaviors and patterns, things that have worked before, to see what we can learn from that to apply in a current situation, perhaps. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching. So the focus should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. So, the antithesis of that, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful neuronal networks lie. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. There's a reward mechanism for a novel situation. For example, if you look at an fMRI scan of people having an aha experience, a moment of insight, three different parts of the brain light up that vaults them into a more creative and synthetic state of mind. So it's internally rewarding and it builds on itself. Now contrast that with the brain images of people who look at facts, at directions, non-aha moments. No part of the brain lights up. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. This is why in the beginning we ask the client what they want to focus on in this session. So they began a focus, which also is about what they want to do, where they focus the energy field of their brain, and the beginning of a co-created and collaborative story. And then we ask them where they'd like to get to, what they want to take away, so they write the ending at the beginning. The bookends are there, so we together are collaborating about moving ahead in that developed story with the client as point of reference. When we write a new story and change our minds, we also change our brains, and we have to practice in the right way, because repetition creates wiring of the brain, so it has to be good repetition. You know, if you do a bad thing, or if you do something that doesn't work and repeat it, it will hardwire too. So you want to, this is why you want to have a mentor coach and learn about mentor coaching, to look at how to do deliberate practice and looking at the next step and getting feedback on the things that may be blind spots or maybe things that you give inattention to. Give attention to a new experience, a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively, because what you repeat will get hardwired. Encourage your client to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. So let's look now at a summary of some principles of mentor coaching successful changes. As mentor coaches, we focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on looking at creating options rather than advice or dictates, on looking at the next step to begin to create a system, a model that can be internalized and used in future situations. Since old patterns are hardwired, and it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to change this wiring, the first requirement for the client is claiming ownership of the story. We do that when we ask them in this session, what would you like us to focus on? Followed by the recognition that with their story, they can understand, assess, and change it, and we are facilitators for that. We are catalysts for that change. So here are some important elements that we do to mentor successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying the problem won't solve it. Understanding the dynamics and the origin and the why won't solve it. In fact, this is how people get stuck in therapy and counseling, to go back into a problem to try to solve it or create a better ending. 1,000 better endings later, or even the first better ending later, they have etched that pathway to the problem a little bit more deeply so they can understand all about it, but still not change. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize, a look at where the client wants to begin to lay new mental maps. Regulate a state of mind and manage emotions to promote full focus and optimize a performance state. A performance can be whatever, concentrating, creativity, physical performance. The state of mind needs to match the endeavor. For example, to creatively write is a very different state than to edit. Two different parts of the brain. So you want to enter the state of mind that fits that task. To get in a peak state for a keynote is a very different state than to optimize the state of mind to go to sleep more effectively at night, to relax and ease into that more relaxed and ultimate sleep state. Facilitate insight rather than give advice, usually. People can generally determine between inquiries that prompt insight and attempts at persuasion. Regulate your state of mind to manage emotions. New insights and adaptation occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. Focus, and this is somewhat redundant, but focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress and discourage attention to negative behavior or figuring out why. Why won't help you. Why, to figure out why is just another way to stop. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. If the client, and this is a response to a couple of the questions actually, in the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy to now and next, to the new ideas, to what's adaptive, to possibilities instead of problems. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Permanent change in behavior also means rewiring your brain. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the brain and the mind. And put it in an output channel. Get your client to create an output channel to do something, not just to passively accept it or have put it in action in some way. Here's a very simple example of that. University of Waterloo recently did a study. Half of the matched group read a story to themselves. The other half read the story out loud. They took a test. The people who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel, even if it was just simply reading it out loud. Studies of a broad number of people, and this is to help you with your sample sessions or your engagements with clients, a large study of physician offices, the usual practice is the receptionist writes down the time of the appointment and the date and gives it to the patient. A matched half of the offices and the assistants and the patient ask the patient instead to write down the date and the time of the appointment. The ones that wrote down their appointment, 18% greater show rate, 18% less no-show, in other words. And finally, conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. This helps create the outline to incorporate the new experiences as a storyline and a part of an evolving identity. I'm going to put us on discussion mode if you'll manage the background noise and only come off mute when you're ready to comment or ask a question. Questions, comments by anyone. I want to mention while you're thinking about asking or commenting, this last step of looking at how we can facilitate the client incorporating the change and the transformation as part of their identity becomes what makes change permanent. We're going to address this in a systematic way in the next seminar using the acronym, the ROADMAP, the seven-step process. And the last step, and one of the most important ones, is to program new identity, to help someone incorporate the changes they're making as part of how and who they are, to change the model, their operating model of themselves as they're doing that. That's what makes change last, and not just something that you do and then it's back to Monday morning after the shipboard romance, because one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is we always return to our identity. And when we evolve that identity to incorporate the transformations that we're making, then that makes it permanent without having to think about it. So, questions and comments from anyone?
This is Brian.
Please, go ahead.
Will you create for us or send us via email or form a list of resources? You referenced the Harvard Business Review study. You referenced your website and a 30-minute recording that we could listen to. You mentioned a Yale study about elderly mindset. Will there be books or other resources that we can follow up on or read in between the session or after the whole class is over that we could reference?
Okay, let me think about that, I'll be happy to do that in ways that I can. Now, one thing that I have enjoyed much more from an earlier career of 25 years is practicing and teaching psychiatry psychoanalysis, being a clinical professor at Baylor College, is I don't have to do references anymore. I can take the studies, and I don't have a set list of references as you might think. Now, the only book I've done in the last of the last dozen or so is the Your New Money Story that was just published by Roman and Littlefield. And there are a whole list of references there. But let me put together some practical references for you that you can look at without having to go back to original papers, which is pretty tedious, I can tell you. And I can summarize some things better than that. But let me put together a list of things that I would suggest. And I'll promise to do this by the end of our seminars or just after, because I want to look at what we've covered and what we haven't, or what the kind of shape and configuration of the questions are that would be most helpful to you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Yeah, and thank you for the questions you sent in. Those are excellent too.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Would you start over, please?
I apologize. Sorry. Quick question. I know
this is who. I'm sorry. I didn't hear your name.
I'm sorry. It's Carolyn. Sorry.
Okay. Go ahead.
I know we're running out of time, but I do want to just perhaps even for the next class. I am particularly interested in the discussion around changing your association to the stimulus, and in terms of practice, and you know, where you're working with a client, I'd like you to, if you wouldn't mind, maybe next class, talk about like what that, from a practical standpoint, what that looks like, because that's really kind of interesting. You're right.
Okay,
you do respond
to stimulus. I will do better than that. I'll double down and answer both of those questions. I will send you a neural conditioning chart. It's one page. And it is what I refer to and present some illustrations, how to work it, and a couple of case studies at the reference I mentioned, Master States of Mind. So I'll send you that neuroconditioning chart and the free webinar on the homepage of Mentor Path, because that's going to answer your question more than I could in a few minutes, because that gives illustration. That's a microsystem of change to take an emotional trigger that someone has automatically that's been hardwired because they repeated it. And there's a couple of examples. There's an example from an executive woman that I get, I'm pretty sure I give this on the webinar, of how I initially developed this system and then have refined it since. But the essence is there, because the emotional triggers are seemingly there, and what do you do about them? And this is an answer to that, of how you can create neural reconditioning around the different emotional triggers that instantly boot up a state of mind and an alternative in dealing with that. So I'll send you the print the page, and there's also a download of an outline on this Master State of Mind. That will more, that's my first reference anyhow, so I'm already part way there. So I think that will be helpful, and if you have questions about that, we'll begin there next time.
Okay.
I gave a brief overview. I think the redundant part will be the Robert Reed basketball story, but other than that, it's not going to be too boring, I don't think.
Okay.
So great question.
Thanks so much.
Let me, because I took a little longer than I said, if you guys are okay to spend another couple of minutes, are there any other questions or other things that would be helpful to talk about?
Dave, this is Michael.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, I'm doing all right. Are there specific states of mind that are associated with transitions?
No. Transition is a concept, and it's usually referencing a process rather than an event, as change is. But there are ways to, I guess the closest answer would be a growth mindset, but that's not a state of mind. It's a mindset, which is a map, and we all have different maps. So a growth mindset is to look at and consider possibilities and change in a positive light, but it's not, I'm using mindset, I'm using state of mind in a very specific way, a psychophysiological state, like anxiety, or like confidence, or any of the other specific, or fear, any other state of mind, is like instantly booting up a state that is like a time capsule. If you have suddenly a trigger of fear, like the example that I give on the webinar is an executive woman. We were working very successfully at some other things, and she said, "I'm about to go home on Thanksgiving." And, you know, it's the one area that I go home one major holiday a year, and I think I'm going to make it through. But then after about a day, I will just break down, because everybody in my family just triggers me. You know, and she detailed, as I asked her specifically, where Dad rolled his eyes at her, where sister would target. Everybody knew how to get her. So what she did then was to look at developing this conditioning, neural conditioning chart, to look at each trigger and how each trigger, because the first thing I asked her was, when somebody triggers you and you have a reaction, what's the age of that conversation? She didn't have to think. She said, "I'm 13 and 14 all over again. I'm fighting with my parents. I'm fighting with my sister." That state of mind is a time capsule. And nothing in that time capsule, by definition, will ever change, because it's a time capsule. What you can address is how not to enter that time capsule by having that emotional trigger move to an indication to get grounded and centered and an ideal behavior. And when you do that enough, it rewires your brain. Actually, when you do the mantra enough, like, you know, before I do a keynote, all I have to do, since I don't carry a basketball, is put together my index finger and thumb on one hand, and instantly I'm in a state of mind. I don't have to do the focus phrase. I don't have to take two deep breaths. It's just, boom, instant. So that rewires. You know, the whole process is called neuroconditioning because it rewires your brain, your neural apparatus. So I think this is going to make more sense, Michael, in listening, if you haven't already, to listen to the Master State of Mind. And I will send that neuroconditioning chart. I would suggest for each of you that you put down some emotional triggers. You'll hear how I developed it with the client I had. Put down what emotional triggers, what your usual response is, the usual response that instantly is that state of mind change. Then what you want to do to develop the three components of a mantra, cue, focus, and physiology, and to pre-plan ideal behavior so that whenever that cue happens, so you can recognize it more quickly, get grounded and centered instead of stay immersed in that time capsule, and have a pre-planned ideal behavior or ideal response ready. So when you do that enough, and it's going to take repetition, you'll rewire your brain. So try that. Let's begin here next time and see what you think about that and see if it's useful and if you have questions about it. So that's your assignment. I'll send the link to click on, which is on my homepage of my website, but it's dead center, and the neuroconditioning chart to download and print so that you'll be ready for that. And probably print the outline at the webinar, and it'll be easier to track it, and you can make more sense of it. So thanks for all of the questions you've sent in. They're terrific questions. I'm hoping I can live into addressing them all, and the ones you've raised. We'll pick up right here next time with comments or questions and maybe a progress note about what you think about regulating states of mind. So thanks very, very much for all of your energy and input. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Look forward to picking
up. Thank you.
See you guys.
Thanks.